Richard Fitzwilliams joins me. Good afternoon, Richard. How are you?
Well, in London, 24, 25 degrees, and the cover of conference, the heads of government beginning to... Oh, very, very interesting times.
Yes, and I think the Queen's already given a speech today, has she?
She has, certainly, and it was a very, very moving occasion, because this is... Rather obviously, the next Commonwealth Conference will be held in Malaysia, and she doesn't do long-haul flights anymore. So it's pretty clear that this is her last chogum as head of the Commonwealth. But there's no question about her continued commitment to it, and also her emphasis, firstly, that the Prince of Wales should succeed, or something I've always suspected had to be the case, because you couldn't have a bureaucrat, the Secretary General, and you certainly couldn't have a rotating presidency, because you would have, say, Sri Lanka in the headship, and that would be unacceptable for human rights reasons. But what was so touching was to see in a magnificent ceremony in the ballroom at Buckingham Palace, the Queen greet the representatives of 53 other countries who comprise, so it's something like a fifth of the world's landmass and a third of its population. It's quite an extraordinary organization. It has its weaknesses, of course, because being so loose, it does mean that various human outrages can sometimes go unpunished. Equally, there are very interesting emphasis on trade in the Queen's speech, because this is obviously the post-Brexit intention of the British government to tighten up Commonwealth ties there. And also talking about the environment, the Queen's Commonwealth canopy. There was a wonderful television program where she at 91, she's 92 on Saturday, as you know, with Sir David Attenborough, is also 91, talked about her legacy of the Commonwealth and the idea of environmental protection of rainforests. And also there's the Blue Project of the Commonwealth to remove as much plastic as we can from our oceans.
Absolutely.
So it's got some important purposes. But it was wonderful to see this and to see the Queen so obviously enjoying it.
I missed that TV program. I'm going to try and watch it because there were some great clips in there which I saw. Any news on the wedding? Have you got the invite yet or not?
Well, again, you see, nobody can say if they've got it.
Oh.
I mean, one of the really interesting aspects of this is that they've managed to remove all the controversy linked to whether or not the Obamas have been asked.
Yeah.
We don't know whether they've been asked, but we know they're not going, and for rather obvious reasons, despite the fact Harry got on so well with them over the Invictus Games. But also, Theresa May hasn't been asked, but basically, it isn't a state occasion, it isn't a semi-state occasion. All the 600 who will be in St. George's Chapel have connections of some sort or another with the bride and groom. There won't be, as there was in William and Kate's wedding, some 40 royals and heads of state and some 200 politicians, apparently. So it's a totally different... It is you can't call it intimate, because, I mean, it's going to be pretty vast, but it will be very different from the previous large-scale royal weddings.
Well, I'm obviously not meant to share, but I did get an invite, but I'm a bit worried on what to wear. I don't want to clash with the bride, so I'm going to...
Oh, but wearing, I can assure you, morning dress is totally acceptable.
Right then, Richard.
On the other hand, you raised a very interesting point, and that is, what is Harry going to wear? And we don't know, because in 1999, when Edward married Sophie and became the Earl and Countess of Wessex, he just wore morning dress. Now, will Prince Harry could wear the Blues and Royals uniform, he could wear the Army Air Corps, or will he opt for simple morning dress? We simply don't know, and that brings me to the big question, what Meghan will wear?
Yes.
Who will design the dress?
Oh.
That is a closely kept secret.
Yeah, and that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? That's for sure, at the moment. It's all exciting stuff, of course, and the royal baby on the way as well.
Any day now, because remember, Harry came early, so we simply don't know.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it, and I know you will. And so let's have a look at them. Before we look at the movies today, sadly, the death last week of Milos Forman, and the director, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is that right?
It's very interesting. Czechoslovak born, and somebody, he was 86, and very interesting. career. Very unusual, because he was mainly known for two films which got enormous acclaim, which won Oscars for Best Picture. The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, featuring a priceless performance by Jack Nicholson as Randall, and also a movie that cleaned up at the Oscars, and Amadeus, too, which, based on Peter Schaeffer's play, I mean, absolutely remarkable. F. Murray Abraham, who I happened to meet recently when he was on the London stage, a charming man, was a truly malign and monstrous Salieri. And it was these two films that really, together with The People versus Larry Flint, which I thought was good but somewhat overpraised, it really did amazingly well at film festivals. I enjoyed it. But these were the films that cemented his reputation.
Certainly. And how old was he when he passed away, Richard Newman?
He was 86.
Okay, so a good life, a good long life, and some great movies there in the canon, that's for sure. Sadly missed. And we move on to the films today, and we start off with 120 beats per minute, BPM.
We certainly do. Now, this is a movie which has a documentary style which absolutely knocked me out. I mean, if you want a film which has impact, you really could do no worse than study the way this movie is made, how the colour almost drains from some of the scenes, because it's a desperately powerful movie. It's directed by Robin Campillo. It's set in the early 1990s, during the period of the AIDS epidemic, and it's set in Paris. And this movie, I mean, the way it opens, we meet a group of HIV/AIDS activists discussing tactics. For them, it's a life and death situation, as all have the virus. The government's pace of reform, and also the way the pharmaceutical company Melton Farm says it will reveal trial results in a year's time. I mean, this, what they're trying to do, it literally is a matter of life and death, is to speed up the process of finding a cure. This is powerful. You see people debate, and literally lives are at stake. It's a question also of getting the gay pride march back on its feet, because not unnaturally, AIDS has caused this ghastly effect. And little question also, when the activists die, I mean, some like Jeremy, played by Errol Borenstein, I want something of a send-off. And also, you've got a gay HIV-negative newcomer, Nathan, played by Arnaud Valois, falling for an HIV-positive activist, Sean, a very powerful performance by Nahul Perez-Biscayat. This is a film, it's angry indeed, but it's powerfully shot. What the reason it succeeds so well is it's so understated. There's LGBT actress Adele Hanel as Sophie, who's one of the organizers of the activists, giving an excellent performance. And you have a mixture of a hedonistic life's nightlife, and there are lots of tips of that, intercut with the day-to-day struggle to not only survive, but also in activism, try and pressurize the authorities to find a cure. The way this film is put together is remarkable. You've also got an excellent cast, and I thought it was really, really powerful. You also climactically see some of the effects of this terrible disease.
Well, I saw it seemed to document that time quite well, and kind of put it in a nutshell, I suppose, what was really going on at that time. It's a French language movie, of course, as well, so it's subtitled in English. The passion that comes across on the screen appears to go beyond acting. I think that's the way I would say it. And it looks like it's coming from the actors as well.
I totally agree. Indeed, you could link it with an American film such as Milk. I mean, there's a graphic, very sensitively shot sex scenes. There are performances which, I agree, it's totally without contrivance. And the fact that it is so natural, and it is so convincing, and you don't feel that these are actors, is in fact its essence, because this is the point it makes. It's certainly angry, but it manages to draw you in by it's documentary style, and I mean, I happen to like that type of film anyway, that particular technique, but this really works well.
Okay, and so ratings out of 5 for that one, Richard?
Without question, 5.
Just had an email in from Leslie saying, "Hello, Dave, at the risk of being a nerd, I've heard everyone mispronounce Milos Forman all day. The correct pronunciation is Milos." Okay, so there we are, Milos Forman. Thank you very much, Leslie. And you're not being a nerd, it's absolutely fine. A second one then, Richard, today, and probably some similarities here. Love, Simon.
Yes, indeed, another LGBT film, and it's an important film and very different to the last. The reason it's important is its subject, because it is the first mainstream Hollywood movie, the first movie produced by a major studio to feature a gay teenager as its eponymous hero. I'd also add that directed by Greg Berlanti, it is very contrived. This is Hollywood. It does rather obviously tick certain diversity boxes. But what it also has is a superb performance by Nick Robinson, who plays Simon Spear. Now, he is a closeted gay teenager in Atlanta, Georgia. His family is happy, life is happy. His parents, Jack, played by Dash Duhamel, very amiable, and Jennifer Garner, always good, playing Emily. And he has sister, Nora. He also has some very good best friends. But what he does is start communicating anonymously online with another closeted gay at the same high school. And all he knows of is that he's called Blue, and they connect, and they get in. This gets involved with blackmail when one student called Martin, who wants to get close to Abby, who's a great friend of Simon's, blackmails him by getting hold of his emails, and it's only after Martin disgraces himself at a football game that he posts Simon's emails on the college website. Now, this is a dreadful thing to do, the school's gossip site, therefore everybody knows. So Simon has to come out to his parents. It's a hilarious scene where postulates the idea that what if everyone who was heterosexual had to come out to their parents, and shows scenes that fantasy scenes of the parents being absolutely horror-struck and so forth. So it's got a sense of humour, and it's also got some very good performances, especially Alexandra Shipp, an African-American actress, as Abby, and Catherine Langford as Leah, who fancies Simon and doesn't realise he's gay. The point that has to be made here is that it is a very contrived movie, completely in contrast to the one.
Yes, I can say that.
120 beats per minute. This is a script written in a studio, whereas it has a large number of sensitive moments. It's comedy drama, and bits of it are very funny, sometimes wickedly funny. There are scenes where I did realize that what I was watching was celluloid, even so, of course, because of its subject, to be welcomed.
So it has, for want of a better term, an agenda, I suppose, an angle that it's coming from, and it is what it says on the tin.
Oh, no, absolutely so, and this is the first film of its sort to feature a gay teenager, and it's a coming-of-age movie, which is, on the whole, well done. Catherine Langford as Leah, Alexandra Shipp as Abby, and, above all, Nick Robinson's Simon. We haven't heard the last of Nick Robinson. He gives a performance of very considerable sensitivity, and what he does bring is veracity to a large number of scenes which have been, as it were, written rather obviously by screenwriters trying to balance how audiences are going to respond to this particular subject.
And so it seems like he brought a bit of redemption then, did he, to the film, to the script. So ratings out of 5 then, Richard?
Well, I hovered between 3 and 4 simply because this is a film that absolutely had to be made. It's absolutely bizarre it's taken so long for it to be made. On the other hand, it is flawed. But I'll go to 4 simply because it's been made. Equally, the first of the movies we were discussing is the template for serious movies. And let's hope more studios explore the gay theme in adolescence, but also do some a bit more convincingly.
I'm surprised it's taken so long as well. When you look at other political issues and social issues that are being dealt with for many, many years now in Hollywood, You know, I mean, it'd be the black slaves of America or whatever it may be, the topic. So for it to have taken, yeah, it seems like it's taken a long time. Anyway, Richard, what shall we be looking at next week then?
Well, next week we've got a real surprise with a French film called Custody, and also another Let the Sun Shine In with Juliette Binoche.
Okay, lovely stuff. If anybody wants to find you online, oh, and by the way, apparently you've got some Austrian TV coming around later on, have you? And
they've actually been this morning.
Okay.
I'm going to film for the Royal Box, which is Yahoo's royal wedding coverage a bit later. That's what's happening, yes.
Lovely. And so it's been a busy old time for you at the moment, Richard. If anybody wants to find you online, how can they do that?
It's the website www.richardfitzwilliams.com and Twitter @RFitzWilliams.
Lovely, thank you. Richard Fitzwilliams will speak again soon. Thank you, Richard. Have a good weekend.
A great pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.